Albert Einstein famously said, "Insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting different results." By this definition, the approach humanity has taken to address hunger and food insecurity is totally nuts. The current solutions that we have are the very same strategies that are responsible for the food and environmental crisis we're facing. More of the same will not give us a different outcome. It's past time we take a different approach. Small-scale farmers, pastoralists, hunters, gatherers, urban producers, those are the people who provide 70% of the global food supply and who, ironically, are the people facing food insecurity worldwide. If we have any hope of sustainably reversing food insecurity, not to mention climate change and other assets or aspects of the environmental crisis, we need to restore natural resources, and agriculture is fundamental to doing that.
This episode of Voices from the Field is an inspiring conversation with a trailblazer in ecological agriculture. In it, Gabriela Soto-Velez, an INCAT sustainable agriculture specialist in the Gulf States region, sits down with Christopher Seiko, who needs no introduction for those familiar with sustainable agriculture practices. In 2009, Christopher laid the foundation for Groundswell International, a groundbreaking organization dedicated to empowering small-scale farmers and championing sustainable agriculture methods worldwide. Fast forward to 2024, and Christopher has stepped away from the helm of Groundswell, but his support and passion for the organization's mission remains steadfast. Christopher's journey post-Groundswell led him to establish Aegis Conservation Ecology and Regenerative Development. Christopher and Gabriela delve deep into the heart of ecological agriculture, exploring its transformational potential, evolution, challenges, and pivotal role in shaping sustainable farming practices. Let's listen.
Thank you so much, Chris, for being here. I'm so excited to be able to speak to you today. And I would love to hear more about how you initially got started in agriculture and what led you to founding Groundswell International.
Thanks, Gabriela. It's a pleasure to be here. So my foundation in agriculture goes back to my childhood. My grandparents were farmers. They were mostly dairy farmers, and they had some crops as well, beans mostly, in upstate New York. And we grew up in that environment since I was a little kid. I remember doing hay with my brothers and just roaming around the farm, helping out here and there. And it was just a really great way to grow up and gave me a real keen interest in the land and in nature, and a real appreciation for what farming is, especially family farming. So that, it wasn't a straight line from there to Groundswell. I, like many young people, went off to college, studied something completely different than agriculture, and did a number of jobs before I sort of transitioned back in the direction of agriculture. For me, the pivotal moment was I lived in Ecuador for about 8 years, seven or 8 years back in the early 2000s. And when I was there, I got involved with a organization in the Amazon. It was called the Achana Foundation at the time. I think they've changed their name, but they were supporting small scale farmers to do sustainable agriculture in the Amazon, which was no easy feat. There's a number of unique challenges with tropical ecosystems. And from there, I got involved with some of my friends in Ecuador were involved with other nonprofit organizations. And one in particular, it was called World Neighbors. And they had a really longstanding, well-respected agricultural program worldwide, really. I think they were in 20 or 25 countries. But in Ecuador, they had a really great program led by a close friend of mine named Steve Sherwood, who still lives there, by the way. And so I got involved with World Neighbors and ended up going to work for them for a number of years on the grant side of things, helping to fund their programming. And from World Neighbors with Steve Sherwood, Steve Brescia, Peter Goebbels, and a number of other folks that the people in the world of agroecology may know, we set out to found Groundswell International. There were 12 co-founders. Five were from from the West or from developed countries, and 7 were from partner countries or countries that had worked with World Neighbors and represented local nonprofit organizations in those countries. And it was, you know, of the 12 of us, there was a handful of us who really stayed with it for the next, you know, 15 years or so. And it was, I'm happy to talk more about Groundswell and its work, but that was a sort of my full-time occupation for almost 15 years. And it was a really wonderful experience.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. That sounds like you've lived an incredible life so far. I know that Groundswell, the work that they do, is something that really inspired me to pursue my career in international agricultural development. And that's what ultimately led me to work here at NCAT as well. But I would love if you could just maybe speak about the work that you do at Groundswell and maybe some challenges that are faced in the global South in the realm of agriculture.
Certainly. Well, Groundswell, a little more history on Groundswell first might be informative to the listeners. We started Groundswell in 2009 during the great financial crisis, which ended up actually being a blessing because it allowed us to focus on starting small, which, as I'll hopefully state later, in the principles of agroecology, ecological agriculture is important. But we started off working in Haiti, and shortly after we began, there was the terrible Haiti earthquake. And so we got a flood of funding from that, which was horrible for the country, obviously, but really helped us kickstart Groundswell. So from there, Groundswell has grown to work in 11 countries and with 14 non-governmental organizations who support another 700 and almost 750 grassroots groups across those countries. The Groundswell countries are focused primarily in West Africa and in Central America, and then there's a few other kind of locations outside of there. They have a program in Nepal, and we're starting one up in India. But anyhow, it really took off from that one program in Haiti to, you know, to this global initiative to support agroecological production by small-scale farmers. By 2022, we were supporting almost 165,000 smallholder farmers. And collectively, you know, all the work was supporting almost 1 million people in aside from those farmers directly and their families, you know, people in the communities where they lived. So it was really, again, just a huge, huge growth period, or, you know, over 15 years, going from a few hundred farmers to 165,000 was that was a feat in and of itself, but doing it in a responsible way that respected those people and respected the principles of agroecology. Something I'm proud of, the way we did that. So, you know, in terms of examples of success, there's so many, but one in particular, it's near and dear to my heart, is the program we started in Nepal. It's a really interesting program. It's one of the smaller programs that Groundswell is involved with. And like the program in Haiti, that started after the Nepal earthquake, and I think it was 2015, maybe 2014, if memory serves. But that program is really interesting because the participants are women from the Dalit caste, which is in the Nepalese culture, that's the untouchable caste, which is the most marginalized people in that society are the participants in the program. And they have done incredible things over the past 8 or 9 years. So, you know, that program, again, still remains fairly small, but the transformation the women involved in that program have undergone in the land that they're responsible for and that they're caring for is nothing short of remarkable. Again, I would if anyone is in Nepal, it's if you can, you know, reach out to the Groundswell folks, they'd be happy to share those experiences with you. But that's something I'm really proud of. And I think that, you know, focusing on marginalized people like that and giving them the opportunity to better their own circumstances and through ecological farming is something I think we need to be doing more of as a society, and specifically the nonprofit sector.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I mean, definitely a small group of people, but a huge impact. And often, you know, the most marginalized people, especially women, end up working on the most marginalized land. So that being one of the challenges in some of these global southern locations, would you mind touching on, you know, some more of the challenges that you face working in these different places, aside from the natural disasters that have occurred in both Haiti and Nepal? Would you mind touching on some of the challenges that you faced in the field and what these people are trying to overcome and how you give them the tools to support themselves?
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm glad you refocused us on that, because it's not only a concern for people in developing countries, but in the United States and in Europe. Certainly, the contexts are very different, but some of the challenges are the same. And one of the challenges that small-scale farmers and even medium-sized farmers in those countries, in all countries, I think, face is the unequal playing field. So I don't think there's no doubt in my mind, and I think there's you know, lots of evidence out there that agroecological farming or ecological farming is superior to conventional farming. And, you know, ecologically managed farms produce more food than industrially managed land in ways that protect life, lift people out of poverty, and really help heal the planet. Yet they don't receive the support that large conventional farms support. The problem really comes down, again, these subsidies, it's a money problem. There's too much money and too much of power behind the industrial agricultural paradigm. Governments around the world are spending $700 billion or more on agricultural subsidies, and the lion's share of that is going towards conventional and industrial ag. Most farmers are small-scale farmers globally, if you look at the numbers, yet, you know, direct payments, most of the direct payments and subsidies are going to large farms. In the EU, you know, which you've heard a lot about this in recent years, the EU, 3/4 of the farmers there are working 10 acres or 10 hectares or less of land, yet 80% of the subsidies go to the largest farmers. So, and you can, that plays out across almost every country, right? There's a few very large farms, or not a few, but there's a small proportion of the total farms are these large farms, and they're receiving the vast majority of the subsidies. U.S. subsidies are around $50 billion in 2020, and that was the last figure I could find. And those are also concentrated towards the largest farmers. One interesting note on that, by the way, is U.S. farm subsidies get a lot of attention. But globally, the U.S. doesn't even rank in the top 10 of nations in spending in terms of subsidies. China dwarfs U.S. farm subsidies, and I think it spends 3 or 4 times as much as the U.S. And the EU and Japan combined. So there's subsidies across the world have generated this unequal playing field, and it's really a marvel that many small farms survive at all. And I think that's a testimony to the income generating potential of small scale agriculture and the dedication of small scale farmers to the land that they work. I mean, that's, you hear stories about this all the time, but that's why people, you know, against all odds continue farming these, because it's in their blood. It's what they love. Right. But it's also can be a really good livelihood option, particularly if it receives support from governments, and not only support, but just if there's a more level playing field so they can compete against the larger farms. So that's a long way of saying, I think one of the major challenges is at the moment, this unequal playing field and the unequal support that large farms receive, and the way that, you know, we need to address that is by providing more support to small scale farmers. I'm not saying you necessarily need to cut the subsidies, but find a way to support small scale farming and specifically ecological farming in addition to providing subsidies to large farms if that's the policy decision to do moving forward.
Absolutely. I mean, I can definitely agree with you that when I was managing that 9-acre organic vegetable farm in France, we had almost no help from the government. And sometimes it was really a struggle when we would have a hailstorm and the insurance wouldn't cover it. And so I can really understand that the passion is what keeps driving the people. So thank you so much for touching on that point. And also about the subsidies, you know, it historically supports the 7 most popular crops, corn, soy, wheat, that don't necessarily contribute the most to nutritional security. So those are some other interesting points that we could probably do a whole other podcast on, probably.
Learn how to harvest the sun twice with practical information at NCAT's AgriSolar Clearinghouse. Get access to more than 400 peer-reviewed articles, the latest in agri-solar news, and connect with farmers and solar developers who are working together to make the most out of our shared resources. We'll see you at agrisolarclearinghouse.org.
But I would love to talk about the principles of ecological agriculture and where did you learn this, and then how did you apply this to the farms or the farmers that you were working with in all of these different countries?
It's interesting. I mean, the principle for me, it comes down to working with nature instead of against it. You know, we often, even within the say non-conventional or more ecologically focused disciplines, we talk about conservation agriculture, permaculture, regenerative agriculture, agroecology, right? All these different terms that we use to talk, you know, to their labels that we put on the type of farming we're doing. But when it comes down to it, if you think, you know, if people can just focus on, you know, how can I achieve, you know, improved yields, more income in restoring the natural resource base by working with nature, you know, finding ways that not trying to conquer nature, right? Just working with it. I think that's the core of agroecology and the core of whatever, you know, label we put on it. That's ecological agriculture for me. In contrast to industrial agriculture, which tends to damage and simplify ecosystems, ecological agriculture conserves and even restores biodiversity and ecosystem functions. So that's the way I like to look at it. And if you want to boil it down a little bit, I mean, there are lots of ways we could, there's lots of principles that all tie back into that working with nature instead of against it. I think it's useful to think about it in terms of what strategies, right? Specific practices kind of guide the shift towards ecosystem rehabilitation. Or a good friend of mine, again, one of the co-founders of Groundswell, Steve Sherwood, recently published something for the Food and Agriculture Organization of the UN, and he talks about 6 kind of basic things that define ecological agriculture. You know, the first one is the reduction and elimination of biocides. So, you know, herbicides, pesticides, all of that is in falls under biocides. The second one is reduction or elimination of soil disturbance. So using zero tillage or minimum tillage techniques to reduce ground disturbance, that's the second one. And then maintaining, the third would be constant ground cover and cropping through the use of things like green manures and integrating trees and herbaceous perennials onto the landscape. And then fourth, you know, he mentions enhancement of biodiversity to sustain diverse flora and fauna. And that's important here to note that it's above ground biodiversity and below ground. The role of, you know, microorganisms in agriculture, our understanding of that is nascent, right? We're just there's a lot of research happening now, but there's the below ground biodiversity is hugely important to ecological agriculture. I don't want to say more than above ground biodiversity, but in terms of generating, you know, carbon sequestration and soil fertility, what we're learning about below ground biodiversity is hugely important. And that's going to, I think, going to be the a game changer in terms of scaling agroecology or ecological production in the future. I know that hopefully we'll talk about, you know, what it means, because I've been talking a lot about small scale, but when we talk about scaling and working at a larger units of land, you know, below ground biodiversity is huge. The fifth one that he mentions is, you know, using high organic amendments, mostly things that are going to foment fungal populations to improve soil structure and make plants healthier. So another area below ground biodiversity, you know, is not just the microorganisms, but the fungal communities. Those are hugely important too. And we're learning a lot about that in the last decade or two. A lot of research is going on there. We still have a lot to learn, but the transformation that healthy fungal populations and the remedial effects of healthy fungal populations also on degraded land is hugely important. And then last but not least is the integration of animals and using them holistically to manage and enhance the nutrient cycling and reduce greenhouse gases. That's the sixth one that I would mention in terms of strategies. And I'll mention the name of that article, by the way, by Mr. Sherwood, just because if people want to find it, it's the title's Enabling Farmer-Led Ecosystem Restoration. Steve's I would say nothing short of he's a pioneer in a lot of these areas of study, and he's dedicated his whole life to it. So he's worth reading up on if you have the time.
Thank you so much for expanding upon that. And I loved when you were talking about the silviculture, the incorporation of animals into the agricultural system. You used the word holistic. And I think that that's something that has been so ignored in the past when speaking about agriculture. And I find now when we're moving forward, there is this approach about taking a holistic view of the whole system. And I think that that's really what is going to drive us forward in regenerating our soils and creating more nutritious food. And so it's really exciting to hear you talk about it. And I would love to hear more about, you left Groundswell International in 2023, and I know that you're still very active in supporting of the organization, but you did found your own consulting firm, Aegis Conservation Ecology and Regenerative Development. And I would love to just hear more about what you're doing and if you have any specific examples of work that you've done that you find really exciting.
Yeah, thanks for mentioning Aegis. It's been, you know, interesting. I've done consulting for a number of years in addition to the work I was doing with Groundswell, but just taking on projects here and there that I thought were, you know, worth my investment of time. And, you know, going independent or starting this, my consulting firm and working at it full time in May of this year actually has been an adventure. I think the really gratifying thing about it is that I'm able to work with very large international NGOs and bring the learning that I've had over my career and with Groundswell and the focus on, you know, ecological agriculture and small scale farmers. I'm able to bring that to these large NGOs, which work at scales that, you know, on one of the projects that we're designing, usually the amount of budget and the number of participants may exceed all of what Groundswell does in a year. Right. So so I guess the gratifying piece about it is, I feel like that those INGOs are benefiting from all the hard work that Groundswell and the really dedicated, the people dedicated to ecological agriculture have achieved over the years, right? I'm able to help them weave that into these large-scale projects. And many organizations, I won't say many, a few organizations have really well-developed, and I say organizations, I mean the large INGOs have well-developed conservation agriculture or ecological agricultural programs. And one that deserves mention, I think, is Catholic Relief Services. They have a really incredible program. It's started in Central America and has been ongoing now for over a decade, and it's expanded. They're expanding the that programming to Africa and into the Caribbean and other places. But they've done a really thoughtful job of building a program. Their signature kind of their methodology is called Water Smart Agriculture, and it really shares many of the sort of the strategies that I was just describing earlier. You know, it incorporates many of those strategies. And it's a really good example of how a large INGO can support and promote ecological agriculture at a scale that smaller, you know, nonprofits and organizations can't. So that's just wanted to give them a shout out, because I think they're doing really good work. So yeah, through AGIS, I mean, again, I'm bringing this, my perspective and learning to these larger projects and hopefully guiding them in a away from conventional ag and more towards the ecological side of the farming spectrum. So that's gratifying. You know, I guess specifically, the more going back to the issue of subsidies and how we can support small-scale farming, specifically ecological small-scale farming, we need to invest in it, right? And so through AGIS, I'm able to shift or hopefully, you know, influence you know, the people I'm working with to opt for ecological practices and ecological approaches, whereas before they might have focused more on unconventional techniques or providing, you know, food aid or subsidies for fertilizers or pesticides, things like that. So that's where I'm feeling like I'm making an impact. I won't mention specific projects, but I will say that even before this year, you know, in the past, we have me and other folks who have the similar inclination to support ecological agriculture have, I think, succeeded in moving the dial and getting more funding for the sorts of ecological approaches that we know work and that just have suffered from a lack of funding over the years. And I can talk more about specific programs if you want, but that's 10,000 foot view. I think that's why some of the impact that I think I've been having and why a big reason why I wanted to move from, you know, Groundswell into consulting. I thought I think I can influence things in a positive way at a larger scale in a nutshell.
Well, I definitely think that you're achieving that. So, you know, you've worked in some of the poorest countries with some of the harshest climatic conditions with such limited resources. So taking the work that you've done and applying it to a Western or an American view, how do you think that our American farmers, whether we're talking about small scale farmers or larger farms or ranches, what are some different tools or methodologies that you've worked on, do you think that they could apply to their farms to drive the initiative for more ecological agricultural practices?
Well, I think from the small scale perspective, small scale farmers, I think two things stick out in my mind, right? I think the integration of animals is, and you touched on that a moment ago as well. I mean, that's, you know, using animals wisely on a small farm can really transform the production, right? And it depends on the context, obviously, but integrating, you know, there's an array of animals you could integrate, but, you know, even chickens on a really small scale farm can bring a lot to the system. You know, goats, if managed properly, could be a really good option. They have lots of different roles they can play in a small scale system. And then, you know, people who are like from the permaculture belt bent are using, you know, fish and aquaculture. There's lots of applications there. And so just, I think thinking outside the just plants and soil, you can or improving soil, through organic manures and things like that. You can integration of animals can do a lot of that for you without basically producing the inputs right on farm, right? So I don't know if that makes sense, but I think that's a really big one. And the other one is, I think this is implicable at all scales of farming, but improving the microorganisms in the soil, improving soil fertility is key. We know that, right, for crop production. But how we do that and how we do that quickly, our understanding that's changing a lot. There's a lot of research going on right now about bioinoculants. And I think bioinoculants will have the capacity to really accelerate improvements in soil fertility. And so for large scale farmers, it's easier to improve soil fertility if you have, a few acres, right? Like it's just, but if you're talking about extensions of land in the thousands or tens of thousands of acres in the United States, to do that cost effectively is going to be a primary concern. And so biological inoculants, I think are going to be the way to do that. I think that's, again, I could point people in the directions of some of that research, and maybe you can post some links to this podcast afterwards. But for me, that's the transformation that's going to happen over the next decade. It's how to transform soil fertility using bioinoculants is going to be central to that.
I couldn't agree more. That's something that I'm growing my interest in right now. I was recently, yesterday at Echo Global Farms here in Fort Myers, Florida. Have you heard of them before?
It rings a bell. I'd love to learn more though.
Yeah, they have offices in Tanzania and in Thailand, but they do work in developing countries to promote sustainable agricultural practices. And they have a deep litter pig pen where you kind of add the farm waste into the pig pen for them to eat as well to roll on, and then they have kind of like plywood that for the sides that you can take off, and then you can just shovel the compost directly out from the bottom and use that directly on your farm. It's a really amazing practice because it's inoculated with a specific type of bacteria, so there's no odor, which is really amazing for a deep litter pig pen system. And I was also working on a farm in Mayaca, Florida, and they were doing Jadam microbial inoculants with local bacteria and fungi and potatoes for about 3,000 acres. And so learning about that and the impact that it had on the sandy soils here in Florida was really amazing. So thank you so much for sharing about these different things that can be applied on both a small scale and a large scale.
Yeah, I think those are really great examples, really specific examples. I'm thinking too that, even at the home scale, these things are becoming really interesting. Like I've been playing around with bioinoculants, and I used to have a 7-acre, farm in Asheville, and I don't have it anymore for various reasons, but I have a small backyard kind of garden at this point, and I'm messing around with with this stuff on my what was formerly a lawn, right? And yeah, the impact it has in such a short time is mind blowing. So you're talking about the sandy soils of Florida, and we're seeing these incredible transformations in some of the most degraded landscapes in the world. Yeah, the potential is enormous. And so thanks for those really great examples. And I think that people spend their whole careers on this, but you can get a pretty good understanding of it and start experimenting with it on your own pretty easily. And which that's really the point I wanted to make about experimentation. So I didn't mention that as a principle above. I talked more about strategies, but experimentation and local innovation, whether it be, in a developing country and on a farm there or at a farm of any size in the United States or Canada, experiment, play around with things, right? You don't have to apply to the entire farm all at once. Just have some test plots, try different techniques, try different, you know, maybe you use different inoculants on different areas, whatever it is, whatever you're doing, the only way to really figure out if it's going to work in your context is to experiment with it. And I think that's if it's, yeah, it is essentially a principle of ecological agriculture, right? Small scale experimentation, start small and find out what works in your context. It's hugely important.
Absolutely. I mean, I think farmers have always been, you know, citizen scientists in their own regard and are responsible for creating a lot of these practices that we use in small scale regenerative agriculture. I wanted to thank you so much for your time. The lessons that you've taught us and the experiences that you've shared have been so insightful. And you have been a really pivotal person in my career development because you were always really encouraging of me when I was looking for different positions and trying to expand into the international field. So I really wanted to thank you for always lending me your time. But I wanted to ask you, how can people get involved with the work that you're doing? How can they connect with you? How can they support you?
Thanks, Gabriella. It's really gratifying to hear that I made any contribution at all to your decision to pursue ecological agriculture. I'm sure you're going to do great things. I have no doubt about that. In terms of how to get in touch with me, people can find me on LinkedIn. Just type in my name, Christopher Sacco, Aegis Conservation Ecology. You can also reach out to me by email at chris@aegisconservation.com. I'm happy to field questions or talk with people more over email. groundswellinternational.org is the website for Groundswell if you want to find out more about them and their work. Yeah, perhaps we can list some resources too if people want to find Steve Sherwood's work or other, you know, I can point people in the direction for some of the other things we've been talking about where they might learn more.
Yeah, I'll definitely link everything that we've been discussing in the show notes. And you said that you have a new project or a new direction that you're leading into. We won't go too much into it, but it sounds pretty interesting. And I'd love if you would just quickly touch on that.
Absolutely. One of my key concerns since I was a little boy was wildlife conservation. And, you know, you see the disappearance of species of all types at an accelerating rate. And the big reason that is happening is because the expansion of the agricultural frontier and humans, you know, settlements into previously wild lands. One way that we can reverse that or at least slow down the loss of species is by improving the matrix of the areas between wildlands and dense human settlements. And a lot of that land currently is occupied by farms, right? So if we improve the quality of the land that we are farming on, we will support conservation of species and improve biodiversity. And so, you know, I'm looking for ways, and I'm working on different initiatives right now that allow me to hopefully make a contribution there. And I'm happy to share more about that when it's a little firmer. But that's what I'm focusing on outside of my consulting time.
That's amazing. Sounds like we're going to have another podcast on our hands in some time. So stay tuned for that. I just wanted to let you know how grateful I am for your time and for all of the valuable insights that you've shared with us today. And I just look forward to being able to see the work that you're doing in the future. And I'll link all of the show notes, all of the links in the show notes that you were discussing before. But thank you again for your time. And everybody go check out Chris Sacco's work. And I hope you have a great day.
Thanks, Gabriella. Appreciate your time. And I look forward to talking again soon.
That's it for this episode. Thanks for listening. Additional information about this episode and related resources can be found at atra.incat.org. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe to Voices from the Field wherever you get your podcasts. I'm your host, Rich Myers. ATRA, Voices from the Field, is produced by the National Center for Appropriate Technology, headquartered in Butte, Montana. It's supported by the USDA Rural Business Cooperative Service as part of NCAT's ATRA Sustainable Agriculture Program. Any opinions, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this recording are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect the views of the USDA or NCAT. We'll catch you again next week, and until then, keep on farming.